Welcome back to the 76 Capital Sports Leadership Show. My name is Ty Jackson, and today 76 Capital's managing partner Wayne Kimmel speaks with Mike Sielski, author of The Rise, Kobe Bryant, and the Pursuit of Immortality, which explores the life of a young Kobe living in Philadelphia. Hope you enjoy today's episode. Nerd Street is a national network of esports facilities, content, and events dedicated to powering competitive opportunities for gamers. The company provides opportunities for gamers of all ages and skill levels to participate in esports tournaments, camps, private events, and more for a wide variety of video games. Learn more at nerdstreet.com. That's nerdstreet.com.
Welcome back to the 76 Capital Sports Leadership Show. My name is Wayne Kimmel, managing partner of 76 Capital, the sports venture capital company. On this show, I interview top sports entrepreneurs, athletes, and executives who are shaping and many times changing the sports business industry. Today, we're going to talk Kobe Bryant with Mike Sielski. Mike is a writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer and author of The Rise, Kobe Bryant, and the Pursuit of Immortality. Mike, welcome to the 76 Capital Sports Leadership Show.
Wayne, it's a pleasure, man. Thank you so much for having me.
It's really great to have you on the show. And, you know, I want to jump right into it. I mean, you wrote this amazing book on Kobe, and you've had some really interesting, you know, behind the scenes and really interesting people that you've talked to really tell the story of Kobe. A lot of things in that book that many people had never heard about before with Kobe. So how did this all come together?
So I had covered Kobe sporadically throughout his career with the Lakers. You know, I've been writing in the Philadelphia area for a long time, both for the Inquirer and some other papers, newspapers and websites in the region. And after he died, I ended up writing about a half dozen columns about him for the Inquirer and for Inquirer.com. And it occurred to me at one point that people in the Philadelphia area had one kind of vision of Kobe that was kind of different from what I thought the rest of the country and the West Coast and even the rest of the world had of him. Because he had joined the Lakers when he was so young, when he was 17 years old, people felt like he had kind of grown up before their eyes out on the West Coast. But I knew from living and working in the Philly area that there was this other story, this kind of origin story of Kobe that took place in Lower Merion Township. It took place in Italy while his family was living abroad. There was the fact that Kobe had jumped straight from high school to the NBA. There was the fact that he had led Lower Merion to the state basketball championship. There was all this kind of interesting stuff away from basketball that went into shaping him into the person and figure he became. And I felt like if I could tell that story, if I could tell his origin story, if I could write Batman Begins for the Black Mamba, then I could show everyone how he became the person that he became. So I reached out to a couple of people I knew who were close to him when he was young with this idea about writing a book about early Kobe, and they agreed to help me, and I was off and running.
Well, who were some of those people that did help you kind of find out these origin stories, some of the things that a lot of people didn't know about Kobe?
Well, the two guys who were really at the forefront and really at the core of helping make this project happen were number one, Greg Downer, who is still the Lower Merion boys basketball coach, has been there for more than 30 years, and who was Kobe's coach and was very close to him, remained very close to him throughout his life. Greg was kind of, anytime anything happened about Kobe in the news that was tied to Lower Merion, Greg was kind of the go-to guy for background, for memories, that sort of thing. And so I knew I had to have Greg on board with the project, that he would agree to talk to me, because not only was he such an important person in Kobe's life, but he'd open the door for me to reach other people, teammates, other coaches, people connected to the program who were impacted by Kobe and his death. The other person was a guy named Jeremy Treatment. And if you're familiar at all with the Philadelphia high school and college basketball scene, you know who Jeremy Treatment is. He's become a basketball promoter, sets up tournaments, runs a sports broadcasting camp for high school kids. He's been doing this for a long time. But back in the early and mid-1990s, he was very close to Kobe. He was a confidant of Kobe's, and he was kind of an assistant coach slash media relations representative for the Lower Merion boys basketball team during Kobe's senior year. He was kind of the point man for handling all of Kobe's publicity. And Jeremy and I have been friends for more than 25 years. And he was maybe the first person I reached out to when I got the idea. I said, hey, look, you know, I'm not going to be able to do this if you don't help me. And he was on board from the word go. And so once I had those two guys, things opened up to me in terms of research and reporting and people to talk to and places to get to and all that kind of stuff.
Well, as we talked about, you know, earlier, Jeremy Treatman, as you mentioned, is the also one of the founders, as you mentioned, of the of one of our 76 Capital portfolio companies, the play-by-play sports broadcasting camps. And Jeremy does an amazing job with that. And, you know, he always talks about Kobe and his time with him as that assistant coach and that media relations person. What were some of the things that Jeremy was able to kind of open up for you or give you some really interesting, you know, pieces of information or, you know, that you may not have had if not for him?
Well, this is a long story, Wayne, so I'll keep it as short as I can. So back in 1996, Jeremy, while he was working with Lower Merion and kind of alongside Kobe for the ride, got the idea to try to co-author Kobe's memoir. It would be called My Freshman Year in the NBA, and it would be all about how Kobe was making the jump from Lower Merion to the pros. So the two of them sat down in 1996 and 1997, even early in late in 1995, for a series of interviews. And Jeremy would record these things on micro cassettes, and they were going to be the backbone of this book that they were going to write. And in fact, Jeremy transcribed some of the tapes, but not all of them. As it turned out, the book never came off. The timing was bad. Kobe was making his rise through the league with the Lakers, and, you know, life got in the way. So Jeremy threw the transcripts in a box. He threw the microcassette tapes in another box and kind of forgot about the project for a long time. Fast forward to 2009, 2010. Jeremy and I kind of got the idea of trying to do a book about Kobe's senior year at Lower Merion. And that project fell through because I had to take a new job. I had to move out of the area and move to New York. Again, fast forward to 2020. I've got this idea for Kobe's origin story. Jeremy agrees to talk to me. He gives me the transcripts of some of the tapes that he has. But he says, you know, Mike, it's been 25 years. I don't know where the microcassettes are. I've never found them. So I said, okay, so I'm going through and doing my research. I'm talking to this person and that person and looking up these newspaper articles and that, these books, and doing all the things you need to do to write a book. And it's December 22nd, 2020, 8:30 p.m. And my cell phone rings and it's Jeremy. And Jeremy is in the process of cleaning out his townhouse in Manayunk, in the Manayunk section of Philadelphia, because he's moving to Boca Raton, Florida. He's going to sell the townhouse and move to Boca Raton. And he's cleaning out his basement. And he calls me and he says, Mike, I found the tapes. They were in a box, in a shelf, in his garage. So the I almost dropped the phone. I couldn't believe it. So the next morning, I drive over to the townhouse. I'm masked against COVID. He's masked against COVID. And he reaches into this box and pulls out a giant Ziploc bag full of about 20 microcassettes of interviews that he did with Kobe back in 95, 96, and 97 that no one has heard in more than 20 years. And he hands them over to me. He even had the microcassette recorder that he had used to get the interviews. And I spent the next month listening to those tapes, listening to Kobe talk about his relationship with his parents, the first time he met Michael Jordan, the first time he met Magic Johnson, what it was like to lead Lower Merion to the state championship, what it was like to take Brandy to the Lower Merion senior prom, why he hated Del Harris, his first coach with the Lakers. And it was just this amazing treasure trove of information and insight. I got chills listening to it. I can't think of any other phrase to use other than it was like hearing Kobe's voice from beyond the grave, because I was getting his thoughts and insights into what he was living and how he was living at the time that he was living. It wasn't the memories and recollections of a 40, 41-year-old Kobe Bryant thinking back to when he was 17 or 18 years old, it was the 17 or 18 year old Kobe Bryant relaying these anecdotes to Jeremy in real time.
Well, that's fascinating. And so I have to ask you, on those tapes, you mentioned that it was, he talked about the first time he met Michael Jordan. Do you remember that story?
Yeah, it's actually kind of a two-part story. So when Kobe was in eighth grade, he was 13 years old, maybe 14. When he and his family had just moved back to the Philadelphia area after being in Italy for all those years, because his father was playing professionally over there, Joe, his dad, takes him to a Sixers game and gets him into the Sixers-Bulls game in Philadelphia and gets him into the locker room before the game. And he shakes Michael's hand, and Michael might give him a wristband or something like that. But Kobe actually talks to Horace Grant a little bit. And Horace asks him, do you play basketball? Yes. Are you going to be a superstar? And Kobe says, yes, one day I might be. Fast forward to Kobe's senior year. It's March of his senior year. And he has spent the summer of 1995 scrimmaging and playing pickup with NBA players throughout Philadelphia. John Lucas, who was the Sixers coach at the time, had wanted Kobe to work out with his players. Lucas had designs on drafting Kobe in the 1996 draft if Lucas were still the coach and general manager of the Sixers. So after all that summer, Lucas invites Kobe and Joe Bryant to a Bulls-Sixers game so that Kobe can hang out with guys like Jerry Stackhouse and Vernon Maxwell, and so that he can meet Michael Jordan for real this time. So before the game, Lucas leads Joe and Kobe down to the visiting locker room of the Spectrum. Was it the Spectrum? Yeah, I think it was. And there's Michael talking to the media. And Michael peeks over the crowd of sports writers in front of him and says, hey, Kobe. And Kobe's kind of taken aback. But then he realizes, like, he's a human being. I'm a human being. He shakes Michael's hand. He's taken aback by how big and strong Michael's hand is. And then Michael starts lobbying him. Hey, you're going to go to North Carolina, right? You're going to become a Tar Heel, right? You're going to play for Coach Smith. And Kobe, two things are interesting about that. Number one, Kobe had already made his mind up that he was going to the NBA by then. He just hadn't told anybody yet. So the idea of like Jordan lobbying him to go to college was never going to work. The other thing is, even if Kobe had decided to go to college, he was never going to go. And this comes out in these tapes I got. He was never going to go to North Carolina because as much as he admired Michael and as much as Michael was his hero and his model, Kobe knew I would never be my own man. I would never have my own identity at UNC. I'd always just be the guy who followed Michael. And so even if he had decided to go to college, he was never going to go to North Carolina. And that occurs to him in that moment. And so it's really kind of a touchstone moment in his life. It's the first extended interaction he has with the king. And it's the prospective heir who's, you know, gets his first chance to meet him. Because think about this, Wayne. Jordan wins his last championship with the Bulls in 1998. Only 2 years later, Kobe wins his first with the Lakers. So the distance between them is really not as far as one might have thought.
It's really fascinating. I mean, one of the questions I had for you really was this idea of, did you uncover the reason why Kobe just wanted to take the leap from Lower Merion? And Lower Merion High School is, as we all know, is located right outside of the city of Philadelphia, and why he felt he was ready to go from there, from that program, right to the pros instead of going to maybe not UNC because he didn't want to follow in Michael's footsteps there, but go somewhere else. Were there any other clues or things that you learned over time as to why he just went right for the NBA?
Well, I would say two things, Wayne. Number one, I had a close friend of Kobe's named Anthony Gilbert, who's since gone on to write for Slam Magazine and be kind of a part of the NBA ecosystem. He's told me something that was really insightful about Kobe. He said Kobe wanted everything young. He wanted everything fast. He wanted to get to the NBA fast. He wanted to get married young. He wanted to start a family young. And he ended up doing all of those things. So he just kind of had that mindset that the NBA is my ultimate goal and I want to get there as fast as I possibly can. That's the first part. The second part is, as I mentioned, the summer of 1995, when he gets the chance to play at St. Joseph's Fieldhouse or at Episcopal Academy on the main line of Philadelphia in these pickup games and scrimmages against Jerry Stackhouse and Rick Mahorn and Vernon Maxwell and Sherrone Wright and Sean Bradley. And he's going toe to toe with these guys. There was one anecdote after another I heard from people who were there in that gym who were unfamiliar with Kobe and couldn't believe that he was only 16 or 17 years old at the time, because he was right there with these NBA guys. In some situations, he was the best player on the floor. He didn't dominate all the time, but he was better than them enough of the time that it persuaded him, you know what? I don't need to go to college. Even though he had scored 1080 on his SATs out of 1600, and he could have gone anywhere in the country that he wanted to go, he didn't need to do it. He could go, he convinced himself, I can go straight to the NBA out of high school. And your point about Lower Merion being kind of the suburban school is a really good one, because that was a reason that so many people were skeptical about him being able to make the jump. It's like, he's not playing in the Philadelphia Public League. He's not playing against the best of the best every single game in high school. He was doing that in AAU, but he wasn't doing it at Lower Merion. Like, okay, great. Like, you beat Pencrest and Ridley and these high schools that aren't very good or aren't well known. Like, what makes this kid think he can make the jump? You know, it's not like he's beating the highest caliber of competition at his age group. But because of those pickup games and scrimmages, Kobe knew that he was ready to go straight to the league.
Well, you know, once he did make this decision and he gets drafted, and the interesting thing is he didn't get drafted by the Lakers, right? He got drafted by the Hornets and then was traded to the Lakers.
Correct.
What was his, you know, what did you learn about him all of a sudden going from, you know, the suburbs of Philly out to the West Coast, the bright lights of LA? And was he excited about that? Was that what he wanted? Was it, you know, how did he, and he said in his first coach, he wasn't too thrilled about out there as well. So how did that all go down?
Well, so it was where he wanted to go. He had been a Lakers devotee as a kid. He loved Magic Johnson. He loved Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. He wanted to be a Laker from the time he was small. But was he excited to get there? I think yes, but I think he went into that first year with the Lakers, and that's kind of where the book stops and ends, thinking to a large degree that he was going to be, pardon me, at the center of a team that should be contending for a championship. He didn't look at the Lakers situation and say, okay, I'm going to be on a team that had just acquired Shaquille O'Neal, that already had Eddie Jones and Nick Van Exel, and a bunch of other veterans, and that was rebuilding itself to turn itself into a contender again. And I'm this 17, 18 year old kid, and I'm just going to kind of help out where I can. He didn't look at it that way at all. He talks very explicitly on these tapes about how I'm going to be there with Shaq, and we're not going to settle for one championship or two. We want three championships, four championships, five. You know, we should win the championship the first year. And Kobe's expectation for himself is that he's going to be the star player on a championship caliber team. And you think about it in retrospect, and it's crazy. He was 17 or 18 years old. You know, what player was going to step into the NBA at that age and dominate and lead his team to an NBA championship? But Kobe really thought that. And that mindset leads to two things. Number one, it leads to, as you mentioned, the tension between him and Del Harris, because Harris is constantly on him. Stop dribbling so much. Stop shooting so much. That crap that you did in high school isn't going to work in the NBA. And when he says that to Kobe, all Kobe hears and thinks is, this guy is trying to hold me down. He's, you know, F him. He doesn't know who I am as a player. He's trying to hold me down. He doesn't want me to be the player I know he can be. And then the other aspect of it too is that Kobe is totally isolated socially on that team. The other 11 guys on the Lakers in 1996 and 1997 are men. They have been in the NBA for a while. They're going out to clubs at night. They're going to dinner together. He's 17 or 18 years old. After a game, he's calling up his agent's assistant. His agent was Arne Tellem at the time, and his assistant was a woman named Alyssa Grabow, who kind of took Kobe under her wing. She was kind of his big sister. And she lived in a townhouse in Los Angeles in the Southern California area. And he would go to her townhouse after games to watch episodes of Mr. Bean, the comedy show on HBO, or if she were having a dinner party with with her friends or her roommates, Kobe would be there and not participate in the party. He would just sit on the couch and watch TV because he didn't have anything else to do and didn't have anywhere else to go. And it's kind of revealing. It's really revealing about what he was dealing with at that time in his life, how much basketball was at the forefront of who he was and how much of an adjustment he needed to make to the lifestyle of the NBA. I mean, he was still living with his parents. He bought a house in Pacific Palisades, and his mom and dad and one of his older sisters moved in with him. He would come home and his mom would be cooking dinner for him. You know, the house would smell like warm sugar cookies and vanilla and macaroni and cheese. I mean, it was really kind of stark, the difference between how he was living and what the typical NBA player's life and existence would be at that time.
But what's really interesting about Kobe and his background is also the fact that his father, Joe Bryant, was an NBA player as well, played for the Philadelphia 76ers, and played overseas, right? And he had that experience of being around professional basketball his whole life. What kind of an impact do you think that had on him?
I think it had an impact in a multitude of ways, Wayne. Number one, obviously, he had the God-given athletic talent to be able to be great at basketball, thanks to Joe Bryant being his father. And Joe was a Philadelphia high school and college superstar, played at Bartram High School in Southwest Philly, played at my alma mater, LaSalle, for college, you know, was 6'9", could go behind his back and run the floor and shoot. And he was kind of Magic Johnson in some ways before Magic Johnson. The problem was that nobody in the NBA, or even in college to a certain degree, like, they tried to put him in the post. That, you know, the idea of a 6'9 guy being that skilled to be able to do all the things that a guard could do, Joe was kind of ahead of his time in a way. So his NBA career doesn't work out the way he would like. He doesn't really have the quote unquote Mamba mentality in the way that Kobe did. Joe was the kind of guy who would miss the team bus to practice or would dunk the ball at the time that the NCAA had banned the dunk just because he felt like it, that sort of thing. So the mentality for Kobe really comes from his mother, Pam, who ran the household, was very strict with her kids when it came to academics and behavior and those sorts of things. And Kobe heard from Joe his whole early life about how Joe never felt like he got a fair shot in the NBA. So in 1983, the entire family moves to Italy so that Joe can play professionally over there. And Joe is a king in Italy. He's able to play and shoot and do all the things he couldn't do in the NBA in these leagues in Italy. And Kobe is right there alongside him. He's going to practices. He's going to games. He's got an up-close look at what it means to be a professional from Joe and these Italian players. You know, Kobe was one of the most, he was a great player, but he was probably the most fundamentally sound player you could imagine in terms of his footwork and his shooting ability and his form. And that's all born out of him watching these Italian professional players up close. Here's where I need to be on the court. Here's how I need to move my feet in order to get a shot off against a bigger or stronger opponent. And he's just learning by osmosis for 8 years. And then family is coming home every summer and he's playing in the Sunny Hill League against bigger, better, stronger players. And he's getting himself better that way. So, you know, people ask all the time, was it nature or nurture with Kobe? And I think it was a 50-50 split. He had that desire in him and that ability in him to be great, but he was brought up in an environment and a setting that allowed that to flourish. He was groomed in a lot of ways to be a great basketball player.
Well, you know, many times, you know, people talk about it's, you know, you have to practice and work so hard. I mean, my understanding and from what I've read and, you know, hearing things from reading from what you wrote and others, this guy practiced like crazy. This guy played like crazy. He was just so focused on the game and wanting to be the best. Is that something that you're able to discover, you know, through all your work?
Oh yeah. When he was a kid, he would have a basketball tucked under his arm so often that his mother and aunts would refer to the basketball as his girlfriend. You know, when I spoke to one of his mentors at Lower Merion High School, his sophomore year English teacher, Jean Mastriano, and Jean told me that Kobe said to her at one point that he got very lonely and would often dribble himself to sleep. He gave up a lot of the things that a normal high school kid enjoys in his or her life, a social life, you know, hanging out with friends, going to see a movie, all these sorts of things, because he was so focused on being a great basketball player. He had a kind of a quasi girlfriend throughout his first three and a half years of high school. And their dates, such as they were, consisted of her coming over to the Bryant's house to watch basketball videos of Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson with the family. It's like, boy, Kobe, you're a real romantic, you know? I mean, it's, but that's how immersed in this he was. And there are costs to that. You know, there just are. And so, yeah, I mean, you could see that in an early age. One anecdote in the book that I really love is he and his friend Anthony Gilbert, who I mentioned earlier, would drive around to courts in and around the city and play hoops. And by play hoops, I mean, Anthony had two jobs. Number one, he would rebound for Kobe while Kobe was working on his footwork and shooting three-pointers and dunking and all this stuff. And he was supposed to yell at Kobe, "You're soft. You go to a white school. You couldn't play in the public league." Kobe wanted him to do this so that he would be kind of emotionally girded and have this armor on for all the trash talking that he was already hearing and was going to continue to hear. He wanted to make himself mentally and emotionally tougher. And so he was preparing himself for that by having Anthony scream these things at him. And Kobe was 14 or 15 when he was doing this. I mean, I can't even imagine. I think back to when I was that age, like, you know, it wasn't like I was having, you know, sports writers, you know, test me on my writing ability, but Kobe was doing something similar for himself at that age. And it's just amazing to think about.
Well, I know your book really talks about Kobe and his rise, you know, that's the name of the book. And, you know, but when you look at what happened after your book ends and the things that he did on the court, off the court, what he did from a business perspective, do you believe a lot of the things that you've uncovered and you've written about in the book have really influenced the way that he was in the business world, using, you know, he had such incredible business acumen. I mean, he really was someone who understood business. He was someone who was all about leaving a legacy for the next generation. Do you sort of see these things from your research and writing that this made sense, that these were some of the things that he was doing in the business world way before, you know, I would say even before what LeBron and KD and some of the other, you know, top superstars are doing? He really, you know, with Brian Stiebel and his group over there, I mean, they were ahead of everyone else.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, Wayne. And you totally see that. I'll give you a couple examples. Number one, I referenced his English teacher as sophomore year, Jean Mastriano. She built her entire lesson plan for that semester in that year around the hero's journey, the concept of the hero's journey. So Kobe would read, you know, everyone in her class, and Kobe was one of them in this honors English class, would read the Iliad and the Odyssey, and Mastriano would show Star Wars in class to talk about Luke Skywalker's journey to becoming a Jedi. And she and Kobe talked about this, about how he very much felt he was on that kind of journey, which sounds crazy as a sophomore in high school to think about that, but that's how he saw himself. He was always kind of one step ahead of everybody in thinking ahead about things. So you have that as a sophomore. And then you have him as a senior taking control of his life and his narrative about that life. He knew throughout his senior year, "I'm not going to college. I'm going to the NBA. He only told a precious few number of people that that's what he was doing. He didn't even tell Greg Downer, his high school coach. He never explicitly said it because he wanted to keep it kind of to this core, close circle of people. And I think he liked the attention that it brought him. He liked having this secret that nobody else knew, because what did it allow him to do? It allowed him to kind of control his own destiny, right? Kobe figured out when he was 17 or 18, going through the recruiting process for colleges, you know what? These coaches, Mike Krzyzewski, Dean Smith, Speedy Morris at LaSalle, you name a coach, they need me more than I need them. I'm going to get to where I'm going, regardless of whether I go to one of their colleges and play for one of them or not. So the future is in my own hands, in my own control. And he loved that. So what does that lead to? It leads to the press conference in the spring of 1996, when he announces that he's going to take his talent to the NBA. If that's not a forerunner to what we see nowadays with athletes on social media and their own platforms being able to control their messaging, I don't know what is. And the combination of those two things, to bring it back to your question about business, the hero's journey and control of your own destiny and future kind of fuse in the way that he approaches business, right? He loves storytelling. So he's going to, you know, be part of filmmaking and win an Academy Award for that. He's going to write children's books. He loves storytelling. And I think that gets to the heart of what you're talking about the control that he wanted over his life after basketball. I'm not going to let somebody else dictate to me what my life is going to be once my playing career is over. I've closed that chapter in my life now that I've retired from basketball, and I'm going to move on to all these other things, whether it's business, whether it's the Mamba Academy, whether it's my daughter's lives and, you know, God rest her soul, Gianna's career in basketball. Those sorts of things, Kobe wanted to control them. These are the things that I have and that I can do, and I want them to turn out the way I want them to turn out. And you can see that in the earliest parts of his life.
I mean, Mike, I want to get into some of your background and some of the things that you've done in your career, but I have to ask you, I mean, you seem, you know, so passionate and so involved in Kobe's life and what he represented. I mean, were there things that surprised you, or there things that made you want to really embrace his story, and why did you want to tell this story so badly?
Well, I had always found him to be a fascinating figure, for all the reasons that everybody else found him fascinating, right? He seemed impossible to pigeonhole. Every time you learn, the phrase I've used a lot in talking about the researching and the writing of the book is that every time Kobe was almost like a kaleidoscope or a diamond. Every time you change the angle of how you looked at it, at him, you saw something new and different, the way the light played on him. And there was so much to him, good, bad, complex. And the fact that I felt like I could tell this story of this portion of his life, and that it could, in doing that, it could kind of, you could foresee everything that was to come down the pike for him, was fascinating to me. And there are parts of the book too that get into, you know, the stuff that maybe isn't as wonderful about Kobe. And I don't want to get into that necessarily here, but I wanted to do his entire life kind of justice in the telling of the early part of it. And I found him a totally fascinating figure. The fact that he went to his community high school was something that I really identified with. The fact that he was a new student there, kind of entering the Lower Merion School District in eighth grade. I grew up in Upper Dublin Township, which is not far from Lower Merion. Demographically is very similar to the Lower Merion community. And I entered high school as a new student, as a ninth grader. So in some ways, I connected with Kobe in that regard. His search for his identity, you know, as a black kid who had lived abroad for so many years, coming back to a very posh and diverse suburb of Philadelphia. What was that like for him? You know, what was his existence like? How did he make the adjustment? How did he try to fit in and figure out who he was? You know, that all of that just intrigued me to no end. And the journey in writing and researching this book was just, I loved every minute of it.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on our show and sharing this with us. And Mike, from your perspective, I mean, you mentioned growing up in the suburbs of Philadelphia and Upper Darby, and, you know, how did you get to where you are today as a writer at the Philadelphia Inquirer with an amazing book that you wrote on Kobe, and kind of what's next for you?
Well, I appreciate you saying that, Wayne. I mean, it was something, being a sports writer was something I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to do from the time I was in college. As I said, I went to LaSalle. The writing bug really caught me there. I knew that I wanted to do something sports related with my life. And when I was writing for the student newspaper at LaSalle, I realized, you know, writing was what I wanted that to be. You know, worked my way up, covered high school sports in the late 1990s at local newspapers, and just you know, got a big break by getting a job at the Wall Street Journal in 2010, and then was able to come back to the Philadelphia area and the job I have now. And I have a measure of freedom that allows me to write what I want to write in the way I want to write it that I'm not sure I could ever give up. I just cherish it so much. I'm going to look at other book projects. One of the cool things in doing this book was that it allowed me to take on another project, which was a podcast. I did a 12-part narrative podcast called I Am Kobe. And it's, again, it kind of complements the book in telling Kobe's story kind of primarily through Jeremy Treatman's eyes, kind of through the prism of their friendship. But on that podcast, you can hear these tapes that Jeremy had and that I used in writing the book. You can hear Kobe at 17, 18, 19 talking about his life at that time. And it was really a pleasure to be able to do that. I had never done anything like that before, writing and narrating a podcast. So what do I have coming down the pike? I don't know yet. I'm pursuing, looking into some other book ideas, just kind of going to see what's out there and continue writing for the Inquirer and writing about Philadelphia sports and national sports and getting paid, being very lucky to get paid to do something I love to do.
Well, it's really been a pleasure to have you on our 76 Capital Sports Leadership Show. I mean, the idea of telling Kobe's story, as you say, Kobe Bryant and the pursuit of immortality and this, like the rise of Kobe and the, a lot of these, the backstory and how it all came to be, how he came to be. And the fact that, unfortunately we lost him at such a young age. And, it's one of those things where, this just this past weekend at the NBA All-Star game, I mean, top 75 players in the last 75 years of the NBA. And the fact that Kobe wasn't there, that's a huge hole for many of us.
Yeah, it hurts. It does. In some ways, it doesn't seem real still to this day. I think part of that is because, he died in January of 2020 and the pandemic hit 2 months afterward. And it just, these past 2 years have been so surreal that even having done this book and devoted so much of my time and my life to his life, it still doesn't feel real. I kind of have to remind myself at times that he's gone. And there are a lot of people out there who are hurting still because he's not around.
And he had a lot left to do. Whether that was in the business world.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right about that. I think that kind of amplifies the sadness around his death, is that sense that there was more for him to do. He was only 41 years old. He had this family who he was beginning to devote himself to. And it breaks your heart.
Well, it's sad that he's not here, but the amazing things that he did while he was here, his legacy certainly lives on, and you've done a heck of a job of capturing that. And Mike, it's been great having you on our 76 Capital Leadership Sports Leadership Show, and just wish you the best of luck with your book, with the podcast, and everything that you do next. And hopefully we'll see each other in and around the Philly area and find ways to help each other in the future. So once again, thanks for joining our show.
I enjoyed every minute of it, Wayne. Thank you so much.
Best of luck, and hope everyone has an amazing day. And as you just got to go out there and just go make it happen. And that's what it's all about. Have a great day, everybody.
Media specializes in helping brands, personalities, and influencers build their reach through social media. They provide end-to-end podcast production, content creation, and social media distribution. So if you are looking to build your brand's reach and engage with customers via multimedia production, reach out to the team at 15mmedia today at info@15mmedia.com. Thanks so much for tuning in to today's episode of the 76 Capital Sports Leadership Show with Wayne Kimmel speaking to Mike Sielski, author of The Rise, Kobe Bryant and the Pursuit of Immortality. Hope you enjoyed today's episode. Looking forward to welcoming you back next week.